Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And welcome to another Little Atoms, this week with me, Neil Denny, and the next in our series of guest hosts, Adam Rutherford. Adam has a PhD in genetics, is an editor at Nature, hosts the Nature podcast, writes for The Guardian, fronted the BBC 4 series Cell, and recently hosted a documentary about morality on Radio 4. Earlier this week, Adam and I spoke to Ian McEwan. Ian McEwan has written two collections of stories, First Love, Last Rites and In Between the Sheets, and 12 novels, including The Cement Garden, The Child in Time, The Innocent, Enduring Love, Atonement and Saturday. He won the Booker Prize for Amsterdam in 1998. Ian's latest novel is Solar, published by Jonathan Cape on the 18th of March. Ian, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms.
A real pleasure.
We're here to talk about Solar, your new book, so perhaps you could briefly tell us first of all what it's about.
Well, it's about a sort of fat-lying bastard of a physicist who won the Nobel Prize back in the mid-80s. I have to be very careful to be vague about this date, because some physicists do win the prize every year, who is a sort of philandering, greedy, lying, rather deceitful man. The background noise to Solar is really climate change, climate science. It's the story of a man who starts out vaguely sceptical or generally uninterested, bored by climate science and climate change politics, but who, through a series of accidents, becomes involved, steals another man's ideas, and finally tries to bring to life a prototype of an artificial photosynthesis plant in the deserts of New Mexico, at which point all his previous indiscretions and lies catch up with him, and the whole thing disintegrates at that very point.
So, well, let's jump straight into something that's been mentioned a lot in the coverage already, is the fact that you took part in this Cape Farewell trip, which is, there's a central sequence in the book where Michael Beard goes to the Arctic and with a number of artists. So tell us how that influenced you, basically, to write the book.
Well, it was a very beautiful place, and I spent a week there with a number of artists. Some disreputable elements of the press, and I won't mention the Sunday Times, have tried to make out that I've used Solar to skewer or pour scorn on an artist, but in fact the one artist on that trip who comes out badly is the only novelist on the ship, whom Beard destroys. The novelist suggests that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle paves the way to moral relativism, and Beard takes great exception to this. I used the trip really to distort and change into my own account, and what happens in my novels got very little to do with what happened on that trip, except that we did have a lot of passionate and interesting and quite hilarious debates sometimes about climate change and about the world that we wish to put to rights. And meanwhile, on the other side of a bulkhead was a kit room, changing room, rather dark, obscure, cramped, where we had to keep changing in and out of all this gear we'd been issued with. And it gradually became more and more chaotic. And one idea I came away with and wrote about the following week for The Guardian was that there was a sort of comedy about our immediate aspirations and ambitions when we talk in grand terms and the close-up chaos that can spill around us. So that it was, I don't know, I can't say it was the beginning of this novel, it was just one thought I had in a notebook. I spent some time at a climate change conference in the same year, actually, Potsdam, I knew John Schoenebel, who's Angela Merkel's chief scientific advisor. And he invited me really to be a sort of after-dinner mint. They were very weighty individuals, all Nobel Prize winners. So I spent some time in the company of 30 scientists, mostly mathematicians, economists, physicists, who had won Nobel Prizes. And the collective frisson of so many powerful egos made me think, at that point, if I ever get round to this novel, I'm awarding right now a Nobel Prize to its central character. But really, the novel was driven by its character. I mean, it was a character that were my first thoughts. He sort of loomed the mist, got fatter and badder, as it were, as the book unfolded, and I found myself heaping more and more faults on him.
It's interesting that you describe him as a fat bastard. I mean, he really is he's a shit. And the inevitable question that follows on from that, which I'm sure everyone will ask you, is how closely is it based on, well, not necessarily an individual, but you've just described a whole set of prize winners and the egos that they displayed. So is Beard an amalgam of...
There's no kind of key to this. There are... I mean, I dread... Someone did say, oh, there is a physicist down in the name of university who resembles your character. So I Googled this name, Google Images, and to my relief, he's rather thin. It looked remotely what I had in mind. So I think I'm safe. I take comfort in the fact that... I mean, when Flaubert published Madame Bovary, I think there were about 40 local chemists, pharmacists, who started actions against Flaubert. And there's safety in numbers, I mean, it's self-counseling. But no, he has no origins in any person or amalgams of persons. I should have actually put a disclaimer in front of this book. It seemed to me too obvious to want to do. But I'm not saying that all of humanity are shits, nor am I saying all scientists are shits. But I'm simply saying that we are a great mix of things, and that we are extremely clever, and there are ways of being stupid that only very clever people can seem to attain. And I took no pleasure in this, but I thought that what happened at Copenhagen at the end of last year was very much in the spirit of Michael Beard. You know, cleverness in the form of science that assembled 192 nations, and atavistic impulses in the form of national self-interest and tribalism destroyed the meeting. That's why at the end of the book I made sure I invited Beard to attend.
And in a sense, I felt that it was somewhat of an indictment of this sort of higher echelon of scientists, these very senior figures with Nobel Prizes who sort of coast along at the end of their careers, being invited onto boats with artists and novelists.
Well, actually, the oldest scientist I know is Jim Watson, and he's no slouch. I mean, he might say things that upset people now and then. So, you know, I can't honestly say that all Nobel Prize winners just coast along. It's in the nature of science that probably best work is done in youth, and the grant applications, etc., and the budgets and funds and boring administration science is done, but also all the influence is extended by older men and women. That also is appealing to me. There's a sort of inbuilt tragedy to a science Nobel Prize sense. It's never going to be work that you're just about to do or did last week.
So in some senses you're very, very science literate and you get invited along to these things, and many scientists, the fact that the two of us are interviewing you now, as a novelist you have great scientific literacy and you get invited to these same sort of forums with beard-like characters, possibly. And
well, that's what happens. I mean, you pay the penalty if you invite me to your conferences, then
you must pay the price.
So what about the younger character? What about Tom Aldous? You don't meet so many of them.
No, I don't. Well, my son was a postdoc for 4 years in Glasgow, and I met some of his colleagues. None of them had ponytails. None of them were called Mike. None of them had coloured string around their wrists. But I just devolved a kind of fantasy about such kids, and liked the idea that an older man would be completely paranoid about them because they were talking too fast, they interrupted each other, they were deep into regions of mathematics that he struggles to keep up with. That is the anxiety of age, you know, that the young are running too fast.
One of the other parts of the book that's there's been a lot of sort of critical attention about in the reviews so far is the in the second section of the book where Beard makes an injudicious throwaway comment about women in science and he loses his position. And it's been mentioned a number of times that this sort of parallels what happened to Larry Summers at Harvard. Yeah. And in fact, in the Guardian review, stated that he sort of thought that wasn't, that didn't sort of really, that wouldn't happen in England. It was more of an American thing. But it immediately made me think of, you've just mentioned James Watson, who was the person before Larry Summers immediately jumped out to me as someone who must have influenced that part of the book.
He did, actually. Jim Watson's always saying outrageous things. He once said that stupidity was an illness and one day science and medicine would cure it. He got quite a beating up for that. But he made, you know, some remarks about race and the whole place, you know, a sort of self-pleasuring ecstasy of indignation. And being indignant, I sometimes worry that being indignant has almost replaced sex as a sort of main pleasure for sections of the community. Was it the Natural History Museum immediately said he was not allowed to speak there and universities closed their doors to him and everyone was in a... Instead of just engaging with the thing, great spirals of... So that was part of it too. My own experience of occasional press storm, close friends have been through it. So I, one way or another, I had enough background in this to really just want to have a gentle tease about the nature of the British press. It's curious... kind of screechy, hysterical, partisan, inaccurate, intrusive qualities.
It also makes a comment on the nature of expertise and the nature of scientific expertise specifically, in that one might argue that Jim Watson's comments were beyond his field of specialism, and indeed Michael Beard is, as a physicist, is suddenly engulfed in a world of climate change science.
Well, also in the world of cognitive psychology, about which he knows very little, but you know, knows some tangents of. And
do,
was
do
about
you see
far
that as
from
a
that
problem?
As well, he's about far removed from that as Larry Summers from differential cognitive abilities in men and women, you know, which is actually a very specialised subject, and actually should not be a matter of faith. I mean, it should just be a matter of empirical testing, but it hasn't become like that. You know, it's become very political and ideological. And as I say in my acknowledgements, I was very impressed by a public meeting held in the States, a debate between Steve Pinker and Liz Spelker. Actually, both sides, I thought, were brilliant. I mean, and I know that Steve Pinker thinks he absolutely sort of smeared her all over the ceiling, but I mean, I didn't see it that way at all. I mean, and I don't, you know, I'm just a novelist. What do I know about this? But it should be a matter of empirical debate. So... another little target along the way was running this sort of debate in front of an ICA-type audience. I don't know if you've been to some of those things. There is a sort of curious and very specific like-mindedness there, and if you cross that audience, they can turn on you. So, you know, there was a bit of a tease, too, to that corner of things, and a little hint of the anti-Semitism of some bits of the liberal left that I want to get into. I'm sure you remember the wish by some members of One Union to ban speakers from Israel from academic life. I always thought that shouldn't go unremembered.
This was the UCU.
Yeah, but actually members of that same union rose up
absolutely
and said fuck off. But you know, there was a stretch of time when you thought, well, surely they can't be doing that. And the very people you want to talk to is Israeli academics. And what else? Dragged along the way.
Nick Cohen raised the particular ICA talk where with Martin Amis and Andrew Anthony.
Yeah.
Where famously is, you know, it's gone into London liberal law that a third of the audience wouldn't put their hand up and say that they were morally superior to the Taliban.
Yeah, I wonder if that wasn't just a sort of an old fashioned English thing of not wanting to be say that you're superior to anybody.
Yeah, I think
even
that's
though
probably
you're
true to be honest.
You're absolutely certain that you are jolly well superior. I think there's sort of politeness involved in that.
Not in an ICA crowd.
No. Well, I think there was a rejection of the idea of any kind of absolute. That any human being should be spirit of another, morally spirit of another, they find offensive. Which, again, is another insanity of moral relativism. And then there's science studies, which is an amazing topic. And I've only just been, well, in the last 3 or 4 years, introduced to this teeming world of You know, people who think that genes don't really exist or that they're socially intexted.
Well, that's a real phenomenon. I was reading that in the book and feeling Michael Beard's frustration and indignation, but I had no idea. Even with a genetics background, I had no idea that this was...
No, well, I read it. I read this stuff aloud to my son. In fact, I sent him some of it. And like you, he didn't know it existed. I mean, since he spends his time snipping up things that don't exist, splicing them and expressing them, as it were, it was a matter of... he was dumbfounded, actually. I couldn't get anything out of him. He just, I'm just amazed that anybody thinks such things.
So that brings me on to a question about the indignation that Michael Beard has for pretty much everyone he comes across.
But about indignations, I guess the tone is irritability rather.
Fair enough.
He's a bit scathing.
But he meets artists and he's scathing towards them, but also he meets other scientists and he's scathing towards them. He's scathing towards them because they're young or because they're right or because they're brighter than him.
Or they're women.
So of those sort of reactions with the universal narrator, some of them are yours and some of them are Beard's.
Well, I mean, one lesson I've learned in life is that just because a bad person holds an opinion, it doesn't mean the opinion is untrue. So, you know, one has to be careful here. Not everything a morally disreputable person says is going to be false. If only it was so. You know, if only you could say, well, it can't be true because a bad person's saying it. And also I had to have some latitude. You know, this is... The realism of this novel is somewhat mediated by the fact that there is a comic element. So I had to now and then give Michael Beard things that either I thought were true or half true or just wanted to have fun airing without responsibility.
It's quite a liberty.
Yes. Well, you know, I've earned it. I've been doing this 40-odd years.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with my guest host this week, Adam Rutherford, and we're talking to Ian McEwan about his book Solar. So, at one point in, Michael Beard talks of the Old Testament feeling of some of the rhetoric around climate change. We had the environmentalist Stuart Brand on the show a few weeks ago, and he also gets mentioned in the book, and I wonder if you're a fan of his approach, which is basically the techie, the engineering approach to tackling climate change, rather than the sort of back to medievalism view of perhaps some environmentalists.
Well, worth remembering that the forests of Europe were 85% gone by the 12th century, and the medieval assault on nature was only limited by their limited technology. I mean, I don't think they were gentler than us, and probably far from it. No, I'm entirely in Stuart's camp. I think our ingenuity got us into this. It was very clever of us to find ways of replacing human labour by machines, and those machines we ran on fossil fuels, and our cleverness is going to have to get us out of it. I think the bottle bank is great, and the recycling, and getting a smaller car, and now not having a dog, which I gather carbon footprint is as great as an SUV. I'm very entertained by that. All the virtuous sneering at SUVs now going to have to be accompanied by mass dog slaughter. And that's clearly not going to happen. You know, virtue is not going to work. 6 million people are not going to kill their dogs. And in some ways, the problem could be simply stated. We have to have a different energy source for our civilization. And that's going to require some ingenuity.
Do you think that photovoltaics, solar power, as Michael Beard works on, is a viable solution?
Well, artificial photosynthesis, might be. I'm not sure that covering the world's deserts with 18% silicon solar panels is really going to do it. You're still going to have problems of intermittency. You're still going to have to invent some way of storing electricity. But if you could find a cheap way of splitting water, we'd be home and dry. You could run fuel cell generators and you'd be fine. So it's happening on lab benches. MIT had a little breakthrough when I was halfway through this novel. I've got the name of the guy now. It begins with V. That caused quite a stir. There's a lab in Australia. There's one in Imperial. Phase one of photosynthesis clearly is highly efficient. Quantum mechanics is one way into this. But it's 25 years away. So far away, because you've got to replace the magnesium ion in photosynthesis with something that is industrially available and cheap. And one candidate now is cobalt, but it's all still up in the air. So I'm with Stuart, I think, and reluctantly, and I was amazed at my own shift in position on this, that I think we have to learn to love nuclear for a nuclear civil power for a generation. And I think, I mean, my own distaste for it was always based on its lack of transparency and its connection to the armaments industry. But I don't see any other way around it. I mean, a cold, still night in February, keep the lights on in London. I don't see how you do that with a huge array in the Thames estuary of wind turbines.
But those are political arguments, nothing to do with the actual technology, are they? The two objections that you just raised.
Mm. No, and you know, the French, was it 4/5 of their output comes from nuclear, and they're not all dead yet. Virtuous countries like Germany buy gigawatts of the stuff across the border, as do we. I mean, I think we're going to have to come around to it. Trouble is, it's going to take, you know, 10 years of public planning applications and people like me protesting.
It's interesting that you mentioned that your objection, your distaste to nuclear, was partially to do with it coming out of the military. And some argue that in countries like Sweden, where they didn't have a nuclear weapons program, and they have an extremely high approval rating for nuclear, and they also have, similar to France, they have a very high proportion of their energy is produced by nuclear.
Yeah.
So it's a recognisably irrational argument that one should object to nuclear power because of its history.
Its history, yes, but that history is still with us. I mean, we're about to decide whether to replace Trident, and I hope we don't, but look like we will. But the transparency one is a big issue, and the nuclear industry has to be forced to treat the public like grown-ups, and if they have a leak, to tell us and not conceal the fact. And and their heads must go on the block if there's a leak and it's down to their incompetence. So that, we don't know. I mean, the variation of figures for the deaths following the Chernobyl accident vary from 56 to 8,000. I mean, who knows what that truth is, but it's still far fewer than died in Bhopal. And I think Stuart is right to point that out. And I think he's right too that you want to live the virtuous green life, you should live in a high-density city. So, and I think you have to get your mind around GM crops and not cause people to go hungry because of your own fat and virtue. So I approve hugely of Stuart Brand. I'm going to go and have dinner with him on his tugboat when I get to San Francisco.
A tugboat?
Yeah, he lives on a tugboat.
In San Francisco Harbour. How cool is that?
That's strange.
Yeah.
So we're running out of time, but to finish off, there's just one other thing I wanted to cover. There's, in the existing narrative of global warming at the moment, there is a huge section which is basically global warming deniers. Mm. And if you read their literature, they seem to think that they're in a position of strength at the moment because of various incidents that have happened. This doesn't feature at all in the book, and I wonder if that was deliberate.
Actually, the UEA email stuff and the IPCC Tibetan glacier stuff happened more or less when I finished my draft.
Sure, but the book is set in a world where it's, global warming is happening.
And I could, but I do have Michael Beard's colleague, Toby Hammer, begins to lose faith in the whole project and say, every night I'm seeing on TV these guys in white coats coming on telling me that actually it's all getting colder, and Beard says, and he gives him a list of things that are going on, sea levels rising, people evacuating from the Carteret Islands, and says, relax, it's a catastrophe. Build our station and it's going to triumph. My view of the public mood is that it's largely been run by, seems very powerful, well-organised lobbies. My sense now of this, having been thinking about nothing else for 3 years, is that the physics is so basic and been known since the mid-19th century. A molecule of carbon dioxide traps radiant light at the long wave end of the spectrum. That is known. It's also incontestable that we're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere. We would expect, therefore, temperatures to begin to rise slowly. And we find this is so. And we found this is so by a peer-reviewed process that's been going on for some time. If the denying lobby, which seems to have a lot of resources at its disposal, would like to put up satellites, would like to crawl across the Earth's surface and gather information empirically and write papers and have them peer-reviewed, and demonstrate to us that the Earth is actually, the planet is not getting warmer or is indeed getting cooler, well, you know, I'd be the first to crack out the champagne. But they must come up with empirical data. They sit on the edge waiting for a scientist to make a slip. And science is a messy human process, and there's a bit of competition and jealousy and edginess, and sometimes things are playing wrong, and climate science is fairly new, and the Earth's climate is a massively complex system if you count in the biosphere as well as part of an interactive system. So the burden of proof is the other way, and I think those who are persuaded by the science need to throw it back at them and say, collate the data for us, do the work, be empirical, join in this. We need climate skeptics. I mean, we need to keep the science good, but not climate deniers. A skeptic is someone who shifts his position in the face of new evidence. So we should all be climate skeptics.
Where does this science literacy that you display so casually come from? You say that cobalt might be a contender for replacing magnesium in photosystems B. The book is littered with mentions of quantum physics and stuff that, well, as a professional science journalist, that I still manage to struggle with.
Well, I have no interest in science. I'm just sort of intellectually curious, and it's no good asking these days a priest. If you want to know about the physical world, then you turn to the pages of Nature or Science, or you know, you read the science pages of national newspapers, which have got a lot better in the last 10 years. I think it's just a matter of intellectual curiosity. On top of that, is the undermining fact that, like most novelists, I'm a complete dilettante. I know nothing about quantum mechanics. I've never been able to understand it properly. I can't do the maths, and it's really solar. It's just a matter of smoke and mirrors to give the reader the impression that that Michael Beard does know these things. Well, he's an imaginary being, and I've just got to sprinkle the dust over him to make that seem the case. In 5 years' time, I'll know a fraction of what I know now about climate science, just as when I knew everything there was to know about de Clairvaux syndrome or evolutionary psychology. And people will be asking me questions about this novel in a few years' time, and I will begin to be saying, well, was it cobalt? I can't remember. But at the moment,
I don't believe you, because most people have never even heard of cobalt, certainly most novelists.
But anyone who knows how to use a library knows that you can put yourself in the top fraction of a percentile of the world's experts in 3 afternoons on any subject at all. You can at least appear to be knowledgeable. Because no one else knows anything except, you know, the real experts, and they are even tinier fraction. So, I mean, that's just, you know, using a library or using the internet for that matter, or just the other great thing about researching a novel is that people love to talk about their work. I mean, they will always tell you how they do what they do, and you know, they come alive to talk about their work. So if I went to the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, no end of guys happy to stop what they're doing and tell me what they're about. And that's always a very good, easy access into any subject.
Ian, that's a great point for us to end on. Thanks very much for speaking to us today.
It's been a real honour to be on your marvellous programme.
Thank you so much for saying so.
There you go. Ian McEwan says his novels are smoke mirrors.
Yes, all right, yeah.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.